So, how does a localized missile strike, halfway across the world, instantly trigger a multi-million dollar margin call in New York?
Right. Sounds crazy.
It really does. But today on the Deep Dive, our mission is to look at exactly that. We're looking at how Wall Street processes global chaos. Specifically, we are zeroing in on the June 2026 U.S.-Iran conflict.
Yeah, and we have a really fascinating stack of sources for this one.
We do. We've got the Strategic Research Memorandum, a scenario analysis built for institutional hedge funds, dated June 11th, 2026. And we're pairing that with reports from Reuters, the Energy Information Administration, the International Energy Agency, and major banks like JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley.
It's a lot of data.
Right, because when most of us see a headline about war, the immediate reaction is to think about the politics or obviously the staggering human impact.
Of course.
But for a multi-billion dollar hedge fund, the core question is entirely mechanical. It's about the transmission mechanism. Like, how does that missile strike literally turn into a margin call?
Okay.
So, okay, let's unpack this.
What's fascinating here is that the core market question, it isn't a binary war or peace. Like for a portfolio manager actively deploying capital, the question is whether this localized conflict creates a durable energy security premium,
Right.
or maybe just a temporary shock in implied volatility, or a broader stagflationary crisis that forces a systemic liquidation of assets.
Wow. So it's not just oil goes up.
Exactly. The mathematical answer completely changes depending on the specific scenario, the duration of the shock, and frankly, the internal balance sheet capacity of the fund that's actually executing the trade.
And to really understand how Wall Street trades this conflict, I mean, we first have to understand the physical reality of what is actually sitting on the board.
You have to look at the map.
Yeah, you can't just model derivatives and volatility without looking at the physical map. And the entire conflict centers around one glaring geographic vulnerability, which is, of course, the Strait of Hormuz.
It is the ultimate bottleneck. I mean, based on the EIA data heading into this crisis, roughly 20 million barrels of oil per day move through the Strait of Hormuz.
20 million every day.
Every single day. You are looking at roughly 20% of total global petroleum liquids consumption moving through a waterway that is, it's just 21 miles wide at its narrowest point.
21 miles, that is nothing.
Right, it's incredibly narrow. And if that strait closes, the physical market loses its primary clearing mechanism. There are very few pipeline alternatives that can actually replace that sheer volume of maritime capacity.
And it's not just crude oil either. Like, we're talking about roughly one-fifth of the global liquefied natural gas trade, LNG, moving through that exact same corridor.
Mostly departing from Qatar.
Exactly, heading straight to Asian markets, China, India, South Korea.
And the shock waves, I mean, they are already glaringly visible in the official data. The International Energy Agency reported that global oil supply declined by 1.8 million barrels per day in April of 2026 alone.
Wow, just in April.
Just in April. And total cumulative losses since February of that year hit 12.8 million barrels per day.
Yeah.
The supply chain isn't just threatened here, it is fundamentally disrupted.
I like to think of the Strait of Hormuz like the primary pressure valve in this massive industrial pipeline, like the global economy's circulatory system. When you close that valve abruptly, the pressure doesn't just stop,
Well,
right?
it forcefully redirects.
Right. In the global financial system, that kinetic energy violently blasts into alternative markets. If the blood stops flowing to Asia, the whole body basically goes into shock.
Yeah, and the data backs that up completely because that redirected kinetic energy translates directly into the refined products market.
The refined products, right?
Yeah, so the EIA expects U.S. wholesale diesel and jet fuel prices to jump more than 60% in 2026 compared to their pre-conflict February baselines.
60%.
And gasoline is expected to climb around 50%. But the mechanics here are crucial, because diesel jumps higher and faster because it is a direct input for industrial activity and freight.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right. So when wholesale diesel surges 60%, the cost of maritime shipping skyrockets. Real freight rates just blow out. It hits the agricultural sector during planting season. It decimates airline operating margins.
And eventually, that structural inflation forces its way into the prices you pay as a grocery store.
Exactly. The geopolitical shock transmits directly into your daily cost of living.
Which brings us to the operational reality of actually trying to trade this chaos. Because that specific bottleneck is so critical to global commerce, every single piece of breaking news causes a massive tremor in the pricing models.
Absolutely.
But we have to look at the situation as of, June 11, 2026. The sources paint a picture that is just intensely fluid and entirely contradictory.
Yeah, the memo describes this as a fundamentally fragmented information space.
Right, because just look at the timeline. Reuters reports that Brent crude actually fell back to around $90.60 after President Trump canceled planned strikes.
Right.
But in the exact same trading window, Iran announces a total closure of the strait following earlier attacks. Meanwhile, the U.S. military puts out a statement claiming commercial ships are still operating in and out of the corridor.
Directly pushing back against claims that vessels are actively being struck.
Exactly. So this creates what the research memo brilliantly calls a regime of headline gaps.
It's a great phrase.
It really is. The operational reality on the water isn't a clean, binary state of open or closed. It's this messy, highly opaque mix of selective transits, covert tanker departures operating with their transponders turned off.
And maritime war risk insurance premiums just surging exponentially.
Right. But let me challenge that whole setup for a second. If the military, the government, and the global financial media are all broadcasting completely different versions of reality, isn't a hedge fund manager just gambling at a very expensive casino?
It definitely looks like that.
I mean, if you're building a multi-million dollar position based on whether a specific tanker makes it through a strait tomorrow, and you're basing that on three conflicting headlines, how is that institutional investing?
Well, it looks exactly like gambling from the outside, but the mechanics are fundamentally different. Amateurs gamble on a directional slogan.
A slogan.
Yeah, like they buy crude oil futures because the prevailing narrative is simply war means oil goes up.
Oh, okay.
But smart institutional funds, they do not trade slogans. They trade dispersion. They are actively hunting for what the memo calls disruption convexity.
Disruption convexity. Okay, break down the actual math of that for us.
Sure. So disruption convexity is about engineering an asymmetric payoff matrix. An institutional manager knows the headlines are noise, right?
Right.
So they structure a portfolio that is heavily hedged against the downside of a sudden unexpected ceasefire while simultaneously positioning to capture exponential upside if the physical supply chain breaks down.
So they aren't just blindly buying Brent crude.
Exactly. They might trade the spread between Brent crude, the global benchmark, and Dubai crude, which represents Middle Eastern sour crude.
Because if Hormuz closes, Dubai crude is physically trapped.
And that spread violently dislocates. Furthermore, they trade the crack spreads, isolating the profit margin refiners make by turning raw crude into diesel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, or they might execute a relative value trade, like buying out-of-the-money call options on defense and cybersecurity equities while simultaneously holding short-dated put options on European chemical companies and airlines.
So by doing this, their maximum loss is strictly capped to the option premium they paid, but their upside during a prolonged maritime closure is theoretically uncapped.
Precisely. They're mathematically mapping the financial impact of the chaos, entirely bypassing the need to guess the next news cycle.
So they construct a map of the possibilities instead of trying to predict a single outcome.
Exactly.
And that is exactly what the June 11 memo does with its scenario playbooks. Instead of just walking through a lump of isolated events, the memo groups the extreme paths this conflict could take.
Right.
Let's look at the first group, which is the physical shocks. This covers both a temporary spike and a prolonged closure.
So in a temporary spike scenario, you see massive volatility. Tankers get delayed, and war risk insurance premiums eat into maritime margins.
But the physical oil continues to clear the market.
Yes. Front-month crude oil drastically outperforms long-term contracts.
Right.
Defense and energy equities catch a massive bid, while emerging market economies that rely heavily on imported energy just get hammered.
Right, but the physical flow remains intact.
Exactly.
But then you transition to the prolonged closure. The nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
The strait is effectively shut down for an extended duration. Morgan Stanley's analysis notes that under a severe closure, oil could easily hit $150 to $180 a barrel.
It's massive.
And the memo points out this throws the forward curve into extreme backwardation. Basically, the panic for immediate physical delivery becomes so intense that the front-month premium entirely disconnects from long-term supply fundamentals.
And the knock-on effects in that physical shock scenario are brutal. the liquefied natural gas market completely fractures.
Right, the LNG we talked about.
Yeah, Asian utility companies suddenly realize those massive Qatari LNG cargoes are physically trapped in the Gulf. And they desperately scramble to secure alternative energy just to keep their power grids running. So the regional spreads for LNG blow out to historic levels as a result.
So what does this all mean? It brings up this terrifying concept from the memo called carry bleed.
Yes.
Let's look at the next conceptual grouping, the deflationary trap. Say you are an institutional trader. You looked at the map, you bought into the prolonged closure thesis, and you are holding these highly complex, expensive options contracts waiting for a massive escalation.
But if that escalation does not happen on your precise timeline, the cost of holding those positions slowly bleeds your capital dry.
Carry.
Right. Time decay eats away at the value of the options. It's like paying for doomsday insurance, but doomsday keeps getting delayed. And if the market experiences a sudden ceasefire whipsaw, like an unexpected diplomatic breakthrough, the war premium compresses instantly.
Crude oil sells off violently.
Violently. And those airlines and emerging market importers you were betting against, they experience a massive short squeeze and rally. If a fund is holding unhedged short-dated oil positions, that sudden deflationary shock will entirely wipe them out.
Which pushes us into the final grouping of the playbooks, the systemic contagion. This is where a localized conflict bleeds into the broader architecture of the global economy.
The macro stuff.
Right. The first path here is regional escalation, where the conflict extends far beyond maritime shipping and hits critical infrastructure, maybe triggers systemic cyber attacks on financial clearinghouses.
And in that environment, cross-asset correlation spikes to one.
Everything drops together.
Everything. Stocks, bonds, commodities, they all liquidate simultaneously because cash is the only asset anyone wants. Liquidity completely evaporates.
And even if we look at the alternate path, you know, a diplomatic settlement, the systemic contagion still leaves a permanent mark.
Right. The market does not simply revert to the February baselines. It permanently prices in an energy security premium.
Because global corporations and sovereign governments realize their supply chains are fatally exposed.
Exactly. So they aggressively mandate redundant supply chains, structurally higher defense spending, and permanently elevated physical inventories. The fundamental baseline of what it costs to operate the global economy shifts higher.
And this is where the memo highlights something absolutely critical that is entirely missing from the daily financial news cycle. The true risk of this conflict isn't just the geopolitical shock itself, it's the policy reaction.
Yes. This is the invisible hand driving the entire macro environment. Geopolitics creates the initial shock, but central banks ultimately determine the long-term reality of the market. If oil hits $180 a barrel, it acts as a massive regressive tax on the global consumer. Demand is violently destroyed. At that point, the Federal Reserve is forced into an agonizing stagflationary dilemma.
The inflation versus recession debate.
Exactly. Do they hike interest rates into a commodity-driven inflation shock to maintain price stability, knowing they will crush demand and trigger a deep recession? Or do they cut interest rates to stave off the recession, risking a scenario where structural inflation runs hot and permanently devalues the currency?
Wow.
For a hedge fund manager, trading the geopolitical strike is only step one. Trading the central bank's reaction to that strike is where the actual macroeconomic battle is fought.
But, and this is the craziest part to me, even if you get all of that right, the memo reveals a trap door.
The plumbing.
Yes. Let's say a fund perfectly maps out the physical shock. They correctly anticipate the central bank policy reaction, and their thesis is flawless. They can still lose absolutely everything.
This is perhaps the most vital insight in the entire deep dive. Being intellectually right on the macroeconomics and the geopolitics means absolutely nothing if you are wrong on the plumbing of the financial system.
I think of it like being a brilliant poker player who has mathematically solved the table. You know exactly what cards your opponent is holding. You push all your chips into the center.
Right.
But mid-hand, the casino abruptly announces they are altering the leverage rules, limiting your maximum bet size, and demanding you deposit more cash into your account in the next 10 minutes just to keep your seat at the table.
That captures the exact mechanics of a prime broker margin call. The memo explicitly stresses that a geopolitical shock is fundamentally a balance sheet event.
Right.
A brilliant, highly profitable energy thesis can be instantly, automatically liquidated by a fund's prime broker if the trade relies on illiquid credit markets,
mm-hmm.
or if it inadvertently involves sanctioned counterparties, or even if it is just trapped in an overcrowded consensus trade.
The prime broker does not care about your 12-month macroeconomic thesis.
Not at all. They care about their overnight value-at-risk parameters.
And the memo specifically highlights the 2 a.m. New York time trap, which is just terrifying.
Depth risk, yeah. Imagine a fund has built a massive, complex derivatives position that requires constant active management. Suddenly, a contradictory headline drops, or a ceasefire tweet is published during Asian or Middle Eastern trading hours.
When Western equity markets are closed.
Exactly. If the fund's VAR models blow up at 2 a.m., automated risk systems at the prime broker will begin liquidating the fund's book before the portfolio manager even wakes up.
That is wild.
It is. An institutional manager has to strictly size their positions and utilize specific option structures that mathematically protect them when they physically cannot access the market to trade.
And this mechanical reality exposes a massive divide in the ecosystem between the mega funds and the smaller emerging hedge funds.
Huge divide.
Because the giant multi-billion dollar firms have access to bespoke over-the-counter derivatives. They use multiple prime brokers, meaning they can spread out their margin risk so no single bank can liquidate them.
Yeah.
And they can afford to pay for proprietary tanker data, real-time satellite feeds, and alternative data pipelines. The emerging funds simply do not have that structural leverage. They are forced to express the exact same geopolitical thesis using simple, highly liquid exchange-traded options, which severely limits their flexibility.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this mechanical reality completely changes the entire value proposition of the hedge fund industry. Allocators, mm-hmm. you know, the massive state pension funds, the sovereign wealth funds, the university endowments that actually provide hedge funds with their capital.
Right, the real money.
Exactly. They are no longer paying portfolio managers to generate geopolitical hot takes. They do not pay 2 and 20 fees for someone to just guess right on the news.
They are paying for a completely different product.
They are paying for crisis alpha. They want a repeatable, mathematically audited process for converting geopolitical chaos into risk-controlled, uncorrelated signals.
Like, can the firm's balance sheet survive extreme implied volatility?
Yes. Can the internal risk team actively manage escalating prime broker margin requirements during a liquidity crisis? Can the trading desk execute the thesis across global markets without accidentally violating a rapidly shifting web of international sanctions?
That operational discipline, that survival mechanism, that is the actual product being sold.
Exactly.
It fundamentally shifts how you look at the entire industry. So let's zoom out and summarize the journey we've just mapped out today. We started with the physical vulnerability, right? 20 million barrels of crude oil and a fifth of the world's LNG moving through a geographic bottleneck that is only 21 miles wide.
Barely a stone's throw.
Yeah. Then we navigated a deeply fragmented information space, a regime of headline gaps where military statements and official news constantly contradict each other.
The fog of war.
Right. We moved past the idea of betting on directional slogans and explored how institutional money uses disruption convexity to map out extreme scenarios, from $180 oil and extreme backwardation to sudden deflationary whipsaws that wipe out unhedged capital.
The carry bleed.
Exactly. We layered in the critical central bank dilemma, forcing the Fed to choose between fighting commodity inflation and staving off recession. And finally, we pulled back the curtain on the financial plumbing to reveal that overnight value-at-risk limits and margin calls, not just physical missiles, are the true enemy of a geopolitical trader.
Yeah.
The core takeaway here is that generating true financial value isn't about making bold, definitive predictions. It is entirely about scenario discipline, risk architecture, and surviving discontinuity.
Survival is the metric. And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building directly on the memo's brief mention of alternative data infrastructure.
Okay.
We noted that the largest, most capitalized funds are now utilizing real-time commercial satellite tracking, maritime war risk insurance premiums, and advanced open source intelligence as standard automated inputs for their algorithmic models.
Right.
The specific data feeds that used to be the exclusive domain of state military intelligence agencies are now just baseline Wall Street alpha infrastructure.
That's crazy to think about.
It is. And this raises a deeply provocative question. Are we rapidly entering an era where access to objective reality is becoming a luxury good?
Oh, wow.
Think about the implications of that. If multi-billion dollar hedge funds are executing high-frequency trades based on real-time infrared satellite imagery of tanker movements in the Gulf, while the retail investor, or the undercapitalized firm, is sitting at their desk waiting for a contradictory, politically filtered official press release to hit the wire.
The playing field isn't just tilted.
No, it is fundamentally fractured. The ultimate Wall Street edge in a systemic geopolitical crisis might no longer be employing the smartest macroeconomic analyst. It might simply be possessing the immense structural capital required to see the truth first.
The structural capital required to see the truth first. That is a heavy, incredibly vital thought to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. The next time you see a geopolitical headline flash across your screen, try not to look at it solely as a standalone news event.
Right.
Look at it as the initial spark in a complex web of market transmissions. Look for the underlying mechanism. Think about how that localized action halfway across the world is forcefully redirecting kinetic energy through the physical bottlenecks, navigating the headline gaps, triggering the central bank policy response, and slamming straight into the overnight plumbing of the financial system.
Because that is exactly how Wall Street is looking at it.
Until next time, keep diving.